Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 196 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the third instalment of our Location and the Writer series, Ali Knight explores the murky depths of the Grand Union Canal in London, John Greening takes us to the poetic village of Little Gidding, and Miranda Miller introduces us to Henry James's Lamb House in Rye. First, here's Ali Knight on the Grand Union Canal.
I am a crime writer, and my novels revolve around families. I examine the secrets, jealousies, and thwarted desires that can cause deadly passions to be unleashed against the people we know and love most. My work has been called domestic noir, which broadly means that a lot of the action occurs in homes and workplaces and concerns itself primarily with the female experience. It addresses the idea that the domestic sphere is a challenging and sometimes dangerous place for its inhabitants. I set my books in London. It's where I live, and I've always had an interest in trying to represent something of this vast, ever-changing metropolis in my work. As the initial stability and harmony of the families that feature in my books begins to unravel through the course of the story, the city's chaos and dangers become ever more present and alive. Writers are always looking for fresh perspectives and new ways of telling familiar stories. In my first crime novel, Wink Murder, I wanted the majority of the story to unfold in a Victorian terrace house, set in an identical row, the kind that is seen in every British town. I wanted the proximity of neighbours and pedestrians and the very familiarity of the streetscape to enhance the feeling of isolation for the struggling family within its walls. But I also needed more freedom in how people entered and left the house, so I placed this row of unassuming homes on the Grand Union Canal. The Grand Union snakes for miles through North London before heading west into countryside and ending up in Birmingham. It's never shown on transport maps, which I find ironic, since it was built to take advantage of the exciting new transport technology of the time, the canal boat. There are some rightly famous sections. Scrappy and busy Camden Market, where the smell of falafel and chips hangs over a towpath crowded with cyclists and clubbers. African okapis stare dolefully at you from their enclosure at London Zoo, and further west at Little Venice, admiring tourists pose next to houseboats bright as children's sweets. But for the most part, the canal's miles of towpath are largely forgotten. It skirts allotments, parks, back gardens, dripping underpasses, former factories where every window has long since been smashed. The atmosphere along its London sections changes far more abruptly than the streets of the city themselves. Large parts of it remain unlit, and much of it devoid of people, an unnerving experience even in the middle of the day. It's quiet too, which after the ceaseless roar of the city feels unfamiliar and exposing. For the crime writer, it's a fitting backdrop for private meetings, fighting lovers, or worse. One winter I lived in a flat overlooking the Grand Union in East London. In January a cold snap froze the water. Within hours its hard white surface began to be littered with objects that instead of sinking into the usually brown, opaque depths, lay exposed to tell their own tale of the neighbourhood. 2 days later there was a tide line of rubbish. Wallets, handbags, children's toys, a broken chest of drawers, two bicycles and a moped. When the ice melted, within a few moments all those things had sunk without trace, taking their traumas and stories with them. Occasionally, objects don't sink. I was once cycling along the canal near Park Royal, deep in northwest London, when I saw a floating blue suitcase. It was too far away from the bank for anyone to reach it. It sat unmoving on the still water. I speculated what was inside it, and whether the person who had thrown it had wanted and expected it to sink. I wrote that blue suitcase into the final scene of Wink Murder, because removed from its usual place on top of a wardrobe, this humdrum domestic object had taken on a new and threatening meaning. Hundreds of writers have used London as a location for their novels and try to bring a fresh pair of eyes to well-trodden city backdrops or research new locations within the city. In the last few years, for example, William Boyd has taken his main character in Ordinary Thunderstorms on a literal and metaphorical journey down the Thames, and Sharon Bolton's bestseller Now You See Me included a denouement in the little-known catacombs under Camden Town. I feel the Grand Union serves this function for me, and I have returned to it again in my latest novel, Before I Find You. Here, a love-starved private investigator has her office on Praed Street, Paddington, overlooking the largest maternity unit in London at St Mary's Hospital, where happy but exhausted couples emerge to begin their new lives as parents. Looming up behind the hospital are brash new blocks of offices and luxury flats in yet another example of the capital's development boom that is transforming this former seedy area into something shiny and new. However, the old and inconvenient city refuses to be brushed away entirely. While these new flats and restaurants with their vast plate glass windows might offer up a tempting slice of aspirational waterside living, the canal's dark, opaque and rubbish-filled water can still throw up a few surprises that shock my private investigator to the core. The canal is a location that I find endlessly atmospheric and useful. It is both practical for plot and inspirational for mood, but I feel no pressure to represent it literally. The house on the Grand Union that features in Wink Murder is imagined. It is an amalgamation of other houses I have seen in different locations. I believe that place serves to enhance a novel, but story is king. And if your readers are checking whether Road A really runs over the canal at Point B, or whether a character would really scale some waterside fencing at Point C, you haven't written a good enough novel.
That was Ali Knight, recorded by herself. Next, here's John Greening on Little Gidding.
When my wife and I moved south from Scotland in the 1980s, we discovered that we were to be living in a county that doesn't officially exist. That idea of inhabiting my own version of a Wessex or Barchester appealed from the start, but even more enticing was the fact that in our particular corner of Huntingdonshire, we would only be a cycle ride away from Little Gidding. Long before it became a poem, this was a place name with considerable resonance. In 1626, Nicholas Ferrer, MP, fresh from his heroic work with the doomed Virginia Company, had settled here with his family. Ferrer was a widely travelled and popular man, exceedingly well-read, a successful high flyer, but determinedly and quietly devoted to his faith. He took over the manor house, restored the tiny church, which was being used as a hay barn, and founded a religious community, whose reputation quickly spread. It would be visited by, among others, Charles I and his nephew, Prince Rupert. When T.S. Eliot came this way, just before the Second World War, some 310 years later, the story was already well known. There will be a landmark biography in 1938, and he was by no means the first literary pilgrim. Nicholas Ferrer had been very friendly with both Richard Crashaw and George Herbert, and Herbert held the living of the church at Leighton Bromswell within walking distance, at least in the days when no one thought anything of going 5 miles on foot. Although I sometimes wish that there could be hills and forests or cliffs and dunes, I've come to appreciate the landscape of what the maps insist on calling Cambridgeshire. The very absence of those obvious delights which make other counties tourist destinations keeps our footpaths generally deserted. There are patches among these wolds and copses and rivery pieces of fenage that have managed to hold on to something precious from the past. The patches may not be attractive in themselves, but they connect points of profound interest. Here is the cross-country route along which the body of Queen Catherine was carried from Kimbolton Castle to Peterborough Cathedral, and there is where John Clare rested on his walk home from the asylum in Essex. Down this quiet lane, John Donne must have trotted when he came to inspect the church he was to take over in Keyston. Here's an oak, beneath which Bunyan is said to have preached. And that's the way Wordsworth travelled, en route to St John's College, one dreary morning when the chase rolled over the flat plains of Huntingdon. Passing such spots, it's easy to see how Eliot felt that history is now and England. Perhaps because of this, or maybe simply that London is near enough to reach within a day by coach or on horseback, 62 miles according to our milestone, the area has attracted many distinguished poets such as William Cowper, and a good few were born nearby, Clare of course, but Dryden too. Little Gidding has become a very important place to me. I often cycle out there past the old cruise missile base and the wildlife centre with its eerie jungle cries, towards the converted windmill at Great Gidding. Beyond Steeple Gidding, I turn off the lane and follow a track for a few hundred yards to where the community once lived. It's gone, but the footpath, where in 1642 they saw the king approaching, still runs away southwest beyond the farmhouse. Charles came on three occasions, the last when he was on the run after the Battle of Naseby. It was here, in 2009, that I met and had my only proper conversation with Seamus Heaney, who for many at the time, including me, was undisputed sovereign of contemporary poetry. It was one of those encounters that make such a deep impression they begin to take on the power of personal myth. The occasion was the annual T.S. Eliot Festival, and the Nobel laureate was speaking along with other distinguished writers such as the Scottish poet Robert Crawford, the biographer Lyndall Gordon, and the critic Dennis Donoghue, but it was Heaney whose presence filled the marquee in the garden behind Ferrer House. It was a glorious late June day. He was in shirt sleeves, and after hearing a superb Hiberno-Caledonian rendition of Eliot's poem, what a privileged handful we were, I knew I had to speak to him. We had a friend in common, after all, Dennis O'Driscoll, who had recently published Stepping Stones, his Faber book of interviews with Heaney, a kind of oral biography. In fact, Dennis had dropped hints to me over a snatched lunch in Dublin that the interviews were happening, that the book was on its way long before the rest of the world knew anything about it. When Heaney heard me mention his friend's name, he was all smiles, peering over his little glasses, tilted at a jaunty angle, saying how much the man had done for Irish poetry, and astonishingly, seeming to know who I was, even complimenting me on my work. I muttered about the personal significance of the occasion, that this part of Huntingdonshire was in many ways my omphalos, as the boglands of Mossbourne had been, of course, for Seamus Heaney. Then the conversation moved on to the recent controversy about the Oxford Professor of Poetry, and what a good job Derek Walcott would have done. Chatting with one Nobel Prize winner about another, I somehow kept up my side of the conversation. The ideas welled out of him, and there was no hint at all that he was recovering from a recent stroke. Then suddenly, he was approached to give a reading at a service in Little Gidding Church, some lines from St. John, which was about to start. Unprotestingly, still full of bonhomie, he left. I wish I'd had a copy of my selected poems to give him. That book, titled Hunts, which had only just come out, has at its heart the place where we stood talking poetry, the very spot where Richard Crashaw may have done the same with Nicholas Ferrer, where Ferrer was handed a package containing George Herbert's complete poems sent from his deathbed and decided to have them copied for publication, where T.S. Eliot lingered in 1936 on just such a glorious day, a few lines taking shape in his mind about the May blossom and the pigsty. I did phone Dennis O'Driscoll to ask whether I should perhaps send my book to Dublin, but on hearing the size of the great man's daily mailbag, I felt it was better not to. Shortly after, first Dennis, who was my age, and then Heaney himself died unexpectedly. I'm glad that he spent what little time he had left reading more important things than my poetry, not least Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, which he finished translating in those final months. Nevertheless, I would like my favourite living poet to have at least seen one of my recent Huntingdonshire elegies, and this one now, which is in fact dedicated to my wife Jane, I read in memory of him and of that extraordinary intersection of literary paths. Caught in the space between Christmas and New Year, idly wondering about Huntingdonshire churches, who uses them now? Are we even closer to the fulfilling of Larkin's prophecy? When the man in the 4x4 attempted to winch off the lightning conductor from Little Staunton Spire for the copper, was that the beginning of the final act? Iconoclasts move beyond stained glass and altar screens. They strike at Michelangelo's very finger and bring down the roof. We snub the churches around us and they ignore us back. Though, on my bike before Christmas, I reached Little Gidding and found the chapel unlocked. Not a soul. The community gone. A page of signatures and Eliot on the wall. A bell, no steeple. Nothing for thieves or lightning. But something as shocking struck me as I put on my cycle clips again and rode home to wrap up your present. That book by Richard Dawkins.
That was John Greening. Finally, here's Miranda Miller on Lamb House in Rye.
This graceful early Georgian house is rich in literary associations. It has been in the care of the National Trust since 1950. The rooms upstairs are lived in by a tenant who has to be a literary-minded gardener who will keep the house in suitable condition, ready for visitors. A National Trust plaque on the wall outside describes it as the former home of Henry James, and there's also a plaque on the garden wall in tribute to E.F. Benson. I love the novels of Henry James, who lived here from 1897 to 1914, and it's still possible to imagine his life here as you explore the elegant rooms downstairs. James was in his 50s, and devastated by the failure in London of his play Guy Domville, when he told friends he was looking for a lowly refuge. He was far too great a writer to be altogether crushed, and confided to his notebook, "I take up my old pen again, the pen of all my old unforgettable efforts and sacred struggles. To myself, today, I need say no more. Large and full and high, the future still opens. It is now indeed that I may do the work of my life." When he first saw and fell in love with Lamb House, he wrote to his sister Alice, "I simply sighed and renounced, tried to think no more about it, till at last, out of the blue, a note from the good local ironmonger, to whom I had whispered at the time my hopeless passion, informed me that by the sudden death of its owner, it might perhaps drop into my lap." After a peripatetic life, he seems to have been surprised to find himself committing to one place. "I am just drawing a long breath from having signed, a few moments since, a most portentous parchment, the lease of a smallish, charming, cheap old house in the country, down at Rye, for 21 years. He later bought the house and wrote of the peace he found here. "Letting the wave, after 20 years of London, carry me as far as it would and spend itself as slowly." In Rye, James said, "I stay in solitude. I don't see a creature that, dreadful to relate, I like." In these rooms, he recalled the past and felt free to expand his inner life. Despite his protestations that he lived here as a hermit, he actually had many visitors, as you can see from the photographs in these rooms and the letters in the dining room. As well as his old friends and family from America, George Bernard Shaw, Edith Wharton, H.G. Wells, Max Beerbohm, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, Amy Lowell, Edmund Gosse, and Hugh Walpole all came here. Joseph Conrad, Ford Madox Ford, and Stephen Crane lived nearby. Rudyard Kipling came to see him here, and his expensive new motor car, a great novelty in those days, was an object of curiosity and wonder to local people. But it refused to start for his homeward journey, so James had to walk his guest down to the railway station. James furnished these rooms with advice from his friend Lady Wolseley, who may have been the inspiration for Mrs. Gerrith in his novel The Spoils of Poynton, about a formidable widow who battles with her son Owen over a beautiful house full of valuable antiques. In the dining room, in the corner over the mantelpiece, you can see a small bust of the handsome young sculptor Hendrik Andersen, who James seems to have been unrequitedly in love with. In summer, James wrote, or rather dictated, to his secretary, Theodora Bosanquet, on her Remington typewriter, in the garden room. Built of brick, it stood at right angles to the front of the house and had a large bow window that looked down West Street. After breakfast, James would mount the 8 steps that led up from the garden and disappear for 3 or 4 hours into the garden room, which was destroyed by a bomb during World War II. In winter, he wrote inside the house, in the comfort of the green room. The mellow-walled garden still feels private and timeless. While he lived at Lamb House, James wrote The Awkward Age, The Beast in the Jungle, The Wings of a Dove, The Ambassadors, and The Golden Bowl. Mr. Longdon, in The Awkward Age, lives in a house that might have been inspired by Lamb House. Suggestive of panelled rooms, of precious mahogany, of portraits of women dead, of coloured china glimmering through glass doors and delicate silver reflected on bared tables. The thing was one of those impressions of a particular period that it takes 2 centuries to produce. James loved this house so much that when he fell seriously ill in London in 1916, he asked to be taken back here to die. But, unfortunately, he was too ill to be moved. E.F. Benson visited Lamb House in 1900, while Henry James lived here, and was impressed by James's intricate knowledge of his neighbours' daily lives. Later, when he lived in the house himself, Benson made good use of local gossip in his Map and Lucia books. In 2014, Lamb House was used as the fictional Mallards for a BBC TV adaptation of Map and Lucia, and a temporary replica of the garden room was constructed for filming. Benson was mayor of Rye in the 1930s and confessed, "I liked pomp and ceremony and being prayed for in church on Sunday morning without the disadvantage of being seriously ill." There is an E.F. Benson Society in Rye, and you can take a guided walk around places mentioned in Map and Lucia's Tilling, which was, of course, based on Rye. Rumour Godden, who spent much of her life in India, also lived here from 1968 to 73 with her second husband. She wrote for both children and adults, and when she lived in Lamb House, she said she heard the voices of Miles and Flora, the children in Henry James's Turn of the Screw, when she was writing. 3 of her novels were made into successful films, although the only one she liked was the film Jean Renoir Made of the River, her sensitive autobiographical novel about a young girl coming of age in India. She later said, "What I learned from Jean was absolutely extraordinary, and I could feel myself growing as I worked with him. He was a wonderful man, a real genius." She went to Hollywood to write the script for the film and met Greta Garbo, Charlie Chaplin, and James Mason. However, she detested Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's film of her novel Black Narcissus. "Everything about it was phony," she complained. "The outside shots were done in a Surrey garden, and the Himalayas were just muslin mounted on poles." She was also unhappy with the 1961 film version of The Greengage Summer, starring Kenneth Moore and a very young Susanna York. But here at Lamb House, Rumour Godden also appears to have found peace.
That was Miranda Miller. You can find out more about Ali Knight, John Greening and Miranda Miller on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 196, which was produced by the Writers Aloud team. Coming up in episode 197, in another instalment of our special Poetry Break series, the poets Jackie Wills and our host Julia Copus discuss 2 favourite classic poems by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, How Do I Love Thee and Grief. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.